You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So welcome, everybody. I'm glad the room is full, despite the summer weather outside, or maybe thanks to it to some degree. We have a very, very wonderful event today, and we thank José Viñals, the financial counselor and director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the IMF, to come and share his perspective and thoughts on the main product, which has come out, I think, 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, which is on the topic of monetary challenges and, you know, managing the risks. Jose was before as deputy government and had successive positions at the Bank of Spain, was chairman of European Central Bank International Relations Committee and chairman of Spain's Deposit Guarantee Funds. And he has been a member of the BIS, Bank for International Settlements Committee on Global Financial System, European Central Bank Monetary Policy Committee, and a high-level group appointed by the European Commission to examine economic challenges facing the European Union. So we really couldn't have wished for a better speaker and on a more interesting topic these days, which is so hotly debated everywhere. And we have two panelists associated with Brookings, from Brookings, joining him. Doug Elliott, who's a fellow in economic studies, who's written profusely on the global financial sectors, on pension, on the Eurozone crisis, particularly on Greece, but not only on Greece. For two decades, he was an investment banker, principally at JP Morgan. He's the founder of the Central on Federal Financial Institutions, a think tank devoted to analysis of federal lending and insurance activities, and he also was a visiting scholar at the IMF. And then we have Eshwar Prasad, who holds the New Century Chair in International Trade and Economics. I think it's the best sounding chair at Brookings, you know? New Century Chair in International Trade and Economics. I wish more chairs had such fantastic names. But anyway, he is also the Tolani Senior Professor of Trade Policy at Cornell and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. When he was at the fund, among various positions, he was head of the Financial Studies Division and the China Division at the IMF. So what we'll do today, we will have José Viñals introduce the topic, share the main points about the report. Then we will have first Doug and then Eshwar comment on it. And then I will try to animate a more general discussion, maybe with some questions of mine and then questions from the floor. José, please, thank you very much again for coming. And I think you can take your seats now.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kemal, and good afternoon to all of you. I hope that depriving you from the beautiful afternoon would be worth it, but that's something you will have to only see after the session. As Kemal was saying, a couple of weeks ago, we had the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank, and we published the Global Financial Stability Report, which is the analysis that we do once every 6 months.
We just realized that we can't look at the slides. So we're going to see.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. Now you certainly can. So as I was saying, in our Global Financial Stability Report, what we do is to take the pulse of the global financial situation, and what I'm going to do in the time of my intervention is to give you the gist of it, to give you the key messages so that we can have an interesting conversation later on. As you can see, the title is Global Financial Outlook and Risks. And I want to start by reminding you that this conversation that we are about to have takes place against the background of what we have called from the fund the new mediocre, referring to the very moderate and uneven global economic recovery. And this is not a comfortable place to be for the financial system. And this new mediocre is leading to complex challenges to stability. So what I will do will be to start by giving you the overall assessment of where we are in terms of the global financial situation, and then I'm going to go through the key challenges that, in our view, are being faced by both advanced economies and emerging markets. And I'm going to talk a lot about monetary policy and the relationship between that and financial stability in this in the next few minutes. So let me now tell you a little bit about the overall assessment. And the main thing is that if one looks at the global financial situation, we can see two things. The first is that risks to global financial stability are rising recently. This is a composite indicator of risks to global financial stability. And what you can see is that although fortunately we are far below than what we were at the time of Lehman and earlier in the crisis, but nevertheless, in the recent past, we have had an increase again in risks to global financial stability. And this is not independent from the second feature, which is that risks are rising and rotating to parts of the financial system where they are harder to monitor, to assess, but also harder to address, because we don't have that good policy tools to address them. And this rotation of risks takes different ways. It's a rotation from risks in the banking system, which are rotating towards the non-banking systems, from risks of credit, which are rotating into risks of market liquidity. And there is a third rotation that I will talk about later on, which has to do with risk rotating from advanced economies to emerging markets, something very different from what happened earlier on in the crisis, where risks were concentrated in advanced economies and emerging markets were doing quite well. So this is the overall scene, and I will be more concrete as we advance. Now, what are the main challenges for global financial stability? And I'm going to start with advanced economies. And a lot of these challenges have to do with monetary policy. And the big thing there is to increase the effectiveness, the traction of the accommodative monetary policies that are in place in Japan, in the euro area, while also managing the adverse side effects that they may have on financial stability. And the other monetary policy challenge is to achieve a smooth exit in the case of the United States. So there are entry and exit related challenges. Let me start with the entry challenges and start with the euro area. And there, you know that the big thing is that the European Central Bank has started doing, finally, quantitative easing. And I think that this is great news, that at the end they did it. And they are purchasing now large amounts of sovereign bonds. And the question is this working? And the answer is, it is starting to work. And it's working certainly through the asset price channel. And as you can see there on the left panel, if one looks at the change in asset prices in the euro area, from the moment that markets started discounting quantitative easing, which was following the speech by Mario Draghi at Jackson Hole in August, there's been a very significant reduction in sovereign yields, a very significant reduction of bank lending rates, by the way, both of them in the core and in the periphery. And at the same time, there has been a significant depreciation of the euro and a very large increase in equity prices in the euro area. So all of this is rather broad-based, and it's helping to underpin global domestic demand and net exports, and therefore it's contributing to improving the perspectives, the economic perspectives of the euro area, and also to support inflation expectations, which is key in moving back to price stability. But the asset price channel being important, there is another channel which is even more important in the euro area, and that's the bank lending channel. And that is so because, unlike in the United States, it is bank lending which is the most important provider of funds to the economy rather than markets. And how is that going? Well, if you look at the right panel, which compares the evolution of credit to the private sector, bank credit to the private sector in countries which have had quantitative easing, what you can see is that getting credit to reasonable growth rates takes time. So one needs to be patient. In the euro area, things are starting to be better, although still very close to zero. So the thing is, can something be done in order to accelerate the speed with which credit is being provided in the euro area? Because that would be a tremendous support to the recovery, because the demand for credit is starting to recover. And the answer is yes, there is something that can be done to unclog bank credit in the euro area, and that has to do with dealing with non-performing loans, cleaning up the banking system. And you would say, but wait a minute, you're talking about cleaning up the banking system? Didn't the European Central Bank do the asset quality review and the stress test? Didn't banks raise capital? Isn't the problem been solved? And the answer is, the capital problem has been solved, but the banks still have a lot of bad assets, a lot of non-performing loans, which have to be dealt with. And in fact, there are 900 billion of non-performing loans, of euros, non-performing loans sitting in the balance sheets of European central banks. And why is it that non-performing loans are important for credit, for the supply of credit? Well, because the empirical evidence suggests that all the things equal, when you have higher amounts of non-performing loans, you are less willing to provide credit even to solvent, potentially solvent debtors. So higher non-performing loans, lower lending. And then the question is, why is it that the euro area has such high rate of non-performing loans? And there you can see the comparison between the euro area and the United States. And what you can see is that in the euro area compared to United States, non-performing loans are higher and rising. And a key difference, which explains why this is happening in the euro area and didn't happen in the United States, is that the write-offs, which is the surgery that is performed in order to extract these non-performing loans out of the balance sheets, was a lot faster and more decisive in the case of the United States than in the euro area. So the key message for the European Central Bank, now that it is the single supervisor, is deal with the non-performing loans. And also for the governments, which have to do changes in the legal frameworks, in the national legal frameworks, in order to improve the frameworks for in and out of court debt restructuring and so on. So this is a very important thing to enhance the traction of quantitative easing. But of course, every medicine which is needed to keep the patient alive also has side effects. And one of these side effects has to do with the negative impact that low, very low, even below zero interest rates are having in certain segments of the financial system. And I will use the example of the European life insurance industry. And this is a simplified representation of a stress test which was carried out by the European life insurance authorities, basically asking the question, how is the environment of low interest rates going to affect the solvency of life insurance companies? And this is the baseline scenario that they had. And under that that scenario, one can see that 14% of European Union life insurers would be instantly below solvency minimum. If one were to think of a Japanese scenario in terms of interest rates, which is much lower interest rates over the maturity spectrum going forward, 24% of the life insurers would be below solvency minimum. And if we were to consider the present situation regarding the yield curve and think what would happen if that were to remain with us for a long time, for many years, then we don't have the supervisory information to reproduce these results there, but you can easily infer that the amount of or the percent of life insurers that would be below the solvency minimum would be far higher than 24%. And that's important. It's important because life insurance companies are a very key savings for retirement vehicle in many European countries, for example, in Germany. And also because they hold a large amount of financial assets in the European Union. In fact, they hold more than 4 trillion. And that means that the 4 trillion euros that they hold are a very important source of financing for the euro area economy. And in the yellow bars, you can see how important are their holdings as a percent of total outstanding. So it's quite important. And you want to avoid today problems that they don't materialize tomorrow, because if they materialize tomorrow, you're going to have not only solvency issues, but also cash flow issues, which are going to be very disruptive to bond markets in particular, and are going to play a negative role in the financing, in the life insurance system financing of the European economy. Let me move now to the other monetary policy challenge, which has to do with an exiting country, and that is in the United States. And the challenge for the Fed is to achieve a smooth exit in what has been repeatedly called uncharted territory. And I think there are two challenges that the Fed needs to manage in order to get the smooth exit. The first one is the divergence in views between what the Fed has been signaling through the FOMC and what markets think. And this is just a very stylized representation of the median dots of the FOMC, the yellow line, and what markets think, the blue line, in terms of market prices. So you can see that markets are betting on a much lower exit than the Fed, although markets hold this view with a significant degree of uncertainty, as revealed by the shaded area, which is the market probability distribution of the views of market participants. And the second challenge by the Fed is to achieve a smooth decompression of long-term interest rates. Now, long-term interest rates are slightly above 2%, but still very, very, very low relative to what they should be. And part of the reason why long-term interest rates are so low is because the term premium is also extremely low, is well below its historical average. So the question is, how will the term premium decompress, and how is that going to affect the transmission mechanism from short-term rates to long-term rates? So the baseline scenario is one of smooth decompression. That's what the Fed wants. That's what we all want. But there are two alternative scenarios, which are far from being zero probability events. One is a faster decompression of long-term interest rates, because the term premium, like a spring, will jump, and then you will have something similar to the taper tantrum that we had in May of 2013. So this is a risk. I don't think this is the most likely event, but it's an alternative scenario. And that would have impact on volatility and global repercussions. And then there is another scenario, which is the stalled long-term interest rates, which would happen when the Fed pushes the policy rate up, but the long-term interest rate is not increasing sufficiently because there are capital inflows coming from the rest of the world as a result of the quantitative easing policies in the euro area and Japan and so on. There is money which keeps coming in, and people outside keep buying treasuries, and that means that the prices are high, but the long-term interest rates are low. And then the question is, what would be the reaction of the Fed, and how would that lead them to a faster increase in the policy rate, and what would be the consequences for the dollar, which very much depends on the policy rate? And that's going to be an important part of the story. So as you can see, not an easy a constellation of scenarios. We don't know yet which one is going to end up happening. All of this is even more important because another challenge that we have to deal with is that in spite of the abundance of global monetary liquidity, as depicted by the blue line, market liquidity in terms of what we would call the depth of markets or bad weather liquidity, which is the capacity of markets to be liquid at bad times, that liquidity has been coming down and down. So indicators of market liquidity, of structural liquidity in markets, have been coming down over time, even as global monetary liquidity has been going up. And this is important, and this happens as a result of a number of factors, some of them related to the expansion of the asset management industry, but there are other reasons too. The illiquid markets are key, because this illiquidity you can find in many fixed income markets. You can find it in corporate bond markets, particularly in the high yield segment. You can find in advanced economies. You can find it in emerging markets, in sovereign bond markets, in corporate bond markets. And what that means is that illiquid markets have the potential for the amplification of the price consequences of shocks that will hit the market. So this is a very powerful amplifier of whatever shocks hit the markets in the future. But not only that, illiquid markets tend to come together with higher correlation of asset prices across markets. So the more illiquid are markets, the more is the potential for contagion. So that's a very important issue that was not in the radar screen of policymakers or of us a few years ago, but which now is at the very center, the potential for illiquid markets. All of this is not only important for advanced economies, but also for emerging markets, which may be affected by shocks, which are amplified and extended throughout markets. And in fact, emerging markets have to address global shocks, but in the presence of some domestic vulnerabilities. And I would like to point out to some of these domestic vulnerabilities, in particular relating to the sovereigns, the corporates, and the banks. And I'm going to focus on one issue which I think is going to be critical in the next few years, which is the strength of the dollar and exposure of emerging markets to foreign exchange risk. If one looks at sovereign markets, one can see that there is direct exposure as a result of the foreign exchange debt which has been issued by these markets, and you can see what the situation is in key emerging markets. But on top of that, there is an indirect exposure to foreign exchange risk, because even if you issue in domestic currency your bonds, insofar as foreigners buy these bonds, they will be subject to the temptation of exiting your market if they think that your currency is going to depreciate. So there is this indirect exposure to foreign exchange risk. And if one puts one together with the other, then one has a sort of modified picture where some of the emerging markets in the picture are much more sensitive to foreign exchange risk than what the simple foreign currency debt amounts would tell you. How about the private sector? Well, the private sector has been releveraging a lot in emerging markets, particularly the corporate sector, since in the last few years. And the buildup of foreign exchange debt positions has been significant. And you can see there that this is something which is particularly important in cases like Chile, Poland, Turkey, Russia, or even South Africa. But the important thing is not the exposure to foreign exchange, but the unhedged part of that exposure. And one problem that we have is that we don't have sufficiently good data, systematic data, in order to know to what extent these foreign exchange debt exposures are hedged or not. So this is something that would lead us to be cautious. Now, one further issue in emerging markets is how strong is the banking system? And this is important because the banking system continues being the key provider of financing in emerging markets, both to households and corporates. And the banking system needs to be strong enough to absorb shocks. And this is a characterization of the strength of the banking system in terms of the liquidity buffers. And as you can see, in most cases, the liquidity buffers are high, but not in all cases, which means that in the case of Hungary, of Russia, of India, or Chile, and even South Africa, these loss-absorbing buffers are on the relatively low side. So there is a potential for corporate bank adverse feedback loops that should be monitored, and emerging market authorities should be preemptively acting to avoid any of these feedback loops getting into play. One key emerging market that I want to highlight is China. And you have heard a lot about China, the slowdown in China, and so on. But let me look at something which is very relevant for the financial stability of China, which is that in China, the property market, as you know, was significantly rich in valuation in the past few years. But the market then has been disinflating, and rightly so. But it's very critical to avoid a collapse in market prices. Why? Because the financial system is very exposed to the real estate sector. In fact, as you can see, about 25% of bank credit, by the dotted line, 25% of bank credit is in the form of exposures to the property sector. and about 17% of total credit granted by both banks and non-banks is again concentrated on the real estate sector, on the property sector. So this is a very important issue for China, disinflate but not collapse property prices. So conclusions in terms of the policies which are needed to safeguard financial stability, well, policies that enhance the traction of monetary policy and at the same time financial resilience. To summarize, in advanced economies, maximize the effectiveness, the traction of monetary policy. In countries like the euro area and Japan, monetary policy needs to be better accompanied by fiscal policies, by structural reforms, and in the concrete case of the euro area, by the cleaning up of the non-performing loans which still exist in the banking system. And in the United States, the challenge would be to achieve the smooth exit, something that only time will tell whether can be achieved, but certainly that the Fed doesn't get behind the curve or ahead of the curve of inflation in terms of exiting on the policy rate, and that it can clearly communicate its movements would be very important. At the same time, manage the financial excesses and adverse side effects coming from too low interest rates. And again, prudential policies are key. I gave the example of life insurance companies as an example of non-banks that would be affected, but there are many other things that you can think of where prudential policies would be required, for example, in the asset management industry. Emerging markets, always strong fundamentals, help, have policy buffers, foreign exchange buffers, and then have prudential policies in monitoring the health of corporates, the health of banks, and avoiding the perverse feedback loops that may emerge if any of those are really weak. And at the global level, something very important. Globally, we need to be very attentive to enhancing market liquidity, because illiquid markets is one of the biggest risks and challenges that we have nowadays. And that's something that can only be done in the context of completing and implementing the regulatory reform process. So let me stop here. Thank you.
Just one, I mean, I will turn to Doug in a minute when we're all mic'd, but one question, Jose, when you mentioned the NPLs, can you just briefly tell us or remind us the relationship to the stress tests? In other words, these were NPLs that were taken into account by the stress tests and are still on the books of the banks. So the banks kind of passed the NPL, I mean, most of them passed the stress tests with these NPL on their books. They're not large enough to have created the problem
right
at that point.
Right. I mean, in fact, this was one of the things that the asset quality review did, was to enhance very much the transparency of European banks. And in that context, it turned out that when the ECB did the due diligence on the banking system, they found that about that the banks had about 18%, so nearly 20% higher non-performing exposures, as they call it, than it was previously revealed. So that was a finding of the asset quality review. And then the stress tests as well looked at how much capital should banks have in order to remain solvent in the context of something going wrong with the macroeconomy and so on. And a few banks failed the stress test. They were asked to submit very promptly plans for recapitalization, and this issue was solved. But the non-performing loans were there. Now, the non-performing loans doesn't mean that the bank is insolvent, the bank is solvent, but the non-performing loans are a drag on the banking system. Because if you have non-performing loans, you provision these non-performing loans partly, but over time, if they don't pay, unless you have provisioned them fully, which you don't, this will eat up your capital. So that's a problem. Having 900 billion in non-performing loans means that 900 billion of bank assets are not making money. So that's a drag on the profitability of banks. It's a drag on the capacity of banks to generate profits that go to future capital that allows them to continue lending. So all in all, this is a tremendous barrier to lending. So this is why you need to deal with the non-performing loans in order to remove a disincentive that banks have when they say, should I lend to this marginal borrower or not? And if they say, well, I already have a lot of problems inside of my bank, I'd better not. And the empirical evidence is that all the things equal, banks which have the same level of capitalization, capital ratios, and which are facing the same demand conditions because they are in the same economy, the banks that have lower non-performing loans lend more than the banks which have the higher non-performing loans.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. So we'll start with Doug, with your perspectives.
Okay.
On this, maybe 5 minutes, 6 minutes, something like that.
Sure. Well, there's good news and bad news in following Jose. The bad news is obvious. He has a very high level of substance and presentation. So I prefer to follow somebody who's worse. On the other hand, he's raised quite a lot of very good points. And if you have a chance to read the GFSR, it's chock-a-block with interesting and good analysis. So choosing among these things, simplifying a little bit, it's not a surprise that very loose monetary policies, including quantitative easing, would mean there were more financial stability risks. Basically, with very loose monetary policy, you're trying to push people into taking financial risk. So no surprise that we're seeing an increase in that. That doesn't mean it's the wrong thing to do, because the benefits to the larger economy of having more of that risk-taking, getting the economy going again, I think have outweighed the disadvantages. But looked at just from a financial stability point of view, what Jose is pointing to certainly is no surprise. So the question, as he's pointed out himself, is effectively how you balance these two things. How do you figure out how to deal with those increased financial stability risks while still getting as many benefits as possible from the underlying economic impulse that has come from this risk-taking? And I was very glad to see the highlighting of the European life insurers. So I think they're a great example of the problem, two problems. Search for yield, meaning a willingness to take excessive risk because you're desperate to earn something on your money, combined with the fact there are too many rigidities in government regulation in too many places. In Europe, there are actual requirements in many cases from the regulators to provide a minimum rate of return on life insurers, which is well above what you can actually earn on safe bonds at this point. And I don't think that's any way to run a railroad, as they say. So it's very good to see some quantification there, some highlighting of what EIOPA came up with and some addition to that. I want to follow up on the NPLs as well, since Kamal was picking up on it. And here I agree with the thrust of the GFSR and of Jose. I do think it would be better for Europe to work through these NPLs. But I would have liked to have seen more discussion of what that actually means. Because if you think about dealing with NPLs, there are three aspects of it. One is just start by recognizing the reality. You're always going to manage your financial institution better if you can see what the truth is, so you don't fool yourself. Nobody's going to argue with that part of it. The second thing is, in many cases, your bank isn't probably very good at dealing with a non-performing loan, and there are specialists out there who are much better at it and can also get economies of scale. So you may not be the best holder of that asset once it's gotten to this point. So again, that's a good reason to move it out. But I think if you look at the analyses, the biggest effect of dealing with NPLs is that you have to come up with additional capital to fill the hole. So if you think of NPLs as a representation of a negative amount of capital that hasn't been fully recognized, and you combine that with the capital you do have, what we're saying in many ways is you should raise your capital levels. And it's well known that if you have higher capital levels, you're more likely to make loans. So if you get into the more complicated analysis, I still think the policy recommendation is right, but I think it would have been better to talk through what do we mean by dealing with the NPLs, what are the processes, and how would that play out? Because, for example, we don't necessarily want to go to the European banks and say, the only people who will buy this stuff will give you 50 euro cents on the euro, but do it anyway. If the true economic value is 80 euro cents, maybe we actually want the banks to hold it for some time. So I just want to say it's a little more complicated issue than it might appear on the surface. And then since I know I've got limited time, let me wrap up. I again think it's a great service to focus on the market liquidity risks. This is something I worry about significantly. And there are multiple factors that are making the markets less liquid. But one of them is undesired side effects of a number of regulations that are being placed on the largest dealers who hold inventories of corporate and other bonds. And these are the big banks and affiliates of those banks. There are a number of regulations put in place to make the banks safer that have the effect as well of pushing them to hold much lower inventories. Well, if you have much lower inventories, then and you charge more to your customers for your willingness to hold any inventories at all, then you make the markets less efficient and more volatile. Now, that may be an appropriate trade-off, but to take the devil's advocate argument, and I don't think that the reality is quite this bad, but you could theoretically have a situation in which to make the banks safer, you put requirements on how they operate that make the market so much more volatile that the interconnections between those markets and the banks mean that in a crisis circumstance, you actually make things worse for the banks than if you'd not done this set of rules at all. This is just another way of saying there are a lot of complex interactions here. And one reason I worry about market liquidity is because at least most of the regulatory actions that are having an effect here didn't really consider the effects on market liquidity. They were all in the silo of looking at a bank as a standalone entity. How do you make sure it's safe enough? And owning securities is a risk. Let's make sure that that's handled appropriately. So I am glad you're pointing it out. And I know you weren't making a particular recommendation as to how to handle that. And I know you're not recommending rolling back all the regulations. But as part of calibrating all this, it's important to think about the effects.
Thank you, Doug. And I'll turn to Eshwar now.
Thank you, Kamal. Under Jose's leadership, the GFSR has become a real pleasure to read because not only does it often venture into uncharted territory, but it also sheds new light on territory that has been charted, but in very different ways, and it uncovers very different perspectives that I think are useful to the discussion. So this year's report, I think, highlights a set of risks that we need to be very cognizant about. The key issue, of course, is trying to think about institutions that were in principle doing the right thing. After the financial crisis, the notion of banks being the real problem and fixing the banks as being the key issue, I think, had gotten a great deal of traction. So what this year's GFSR points out, of course, is that a lot of shifts, risks are, as Jose puts it, rotating perhaps out of the banking system, which in many ways has been made safer, to other parts of the financial system. But what I found particularly intriguing in the report was how institutions that we think about as contributing to stability or as diffusing these risks in a much better fashion are in fact potentially going to be sources of risk themselves. One that Jose mentioned but is dealt with in great detail in the report is about mutual funds, and this ties into the issue of liquidity that Doug talked about. How it is that even mutual funds where in principle there is a very clear sense of what sort of risk is involved, and the risk is very nicely dispersed through the system, can in fact create much larger risk because of potential liquidity problems. So if you have people trying to redeem their shares in mutual funds at the same time across a broad range of mutual funds, and there isn't enough market liquidity. You could have mutual funds trying to redeem their holdings, and this creates problems. Now, it's hard to think about that in the classical run sort of context, because unlike in the case of a bank run, where the first few people who show up at the bank door are the ones who get paid off, in a mutual fund, everybody's holdings, NAVs, fall by roughly the same amount. So there isn't the classical concept of a run. But once one ties it in with liquidity, then it does become an issue. Likewise, Jose spoke about how insurance companies and longer-term investors that one thinks about as providing stability to the market, both in a national context as well as an international context, the notion being that these are long-term investors who are not there for short-term gain and therefore are not going to pull out at the first sign of trouble. They're coming under trouble for a different set of reasons associated with monetary policy and very low interest rates. So that's another source of risk that one is not traditionally used to thinking about. And then there is a risk associated with the emerging markets, of course, which are subject to a variety of risks associated with their debt levels. Now, after having posed all these risks, I think there are some interesting questions or points that are worth thinking about. We talk a great deal about financial stability, and it always intrigues me that when we have discussions of this sort, and I think we've all participated in many of these discussions, what exactly is financial stability is something that is very, very hard to get our finger on. So Jose put up a chart that was very nice that provided a measure of risk and showed that that risk measure has actually gone up. So what would financial stability look like? Would it mean that that risk measure drops to zero? Perhaps that would make for a very safe financial system. But then the question becomes whether that financial system is doing what a financial system is meant to do, which is intermediate savings into investment, which inherently has a certain amount of risk associated with it. So I think we need to be thinking more broadly about this trade-off, and Jose did refer to it and Doug did allude to it as well, about what the right trade-off is. How much risk are we willing to accept in individual institutions and at the systemic level in order for the financial system to work well? And there is definitely a risk of overcompensating relating to some of these problems, like the liquidity problem. Now, of course, having said that, one could play devil's advocate to Doug's devil's advocate and say perhaps if you had better regulation of banks, better regulation of financial systems, we would not have in the first place financial shocks that will then cause the liquidity problems to start becoming a big deal, because we would have liquidity problems if we go back to thinking about the way things were back in 2008, 2009. We had financial shocks, and then we say what happened, what would happen if there was no liquidity. The liquidity issue would become a major concern if you did have a system that was vulnerable to financial shocks. And perhaps finance is intrinsically dangerous, so one has to take that into account. But I think these are the very fine sorts of trade-offs that we're going to have to think very hard about. And frankly, being an academic myself, I can tell you that our analytical models are really not up to the task of dealing with this trade-off yet. So it's very nice to have the IMF take the lead, at least on putting a framework on some of these issues. And then Jose talked about the macroeconomic risks. Now, I work a good deal on emerging markets, and I can sense again that the financial market risks are, in a sense, having an effect on the macroeconomic behavior, which in turn, I think, could have broader repercussions. One example is about the local currency, foreign currency denominated debt, especially corporate debt that has been flagged as a significant problem in emerging market economies. Now, one of the things that got many emerging market economies through the crisis and which we see as a success of orthodox policies is that many of these economies now have flexible exchange rates, which acts as a very effective shock absorption mechanism. But if foreign currency denominated debt becomes a bigger issue in these economies, and it already is a big issue, that starts constraining monetary policy, because at some level, the central bank starts recognizing that if it does stick to its policy of a flexible exchange rate, it can have broader financial consequences. So now we have financial problems essentially starting to constrain monetary policy and broader macroeconomic policies as well. And in that sense, although the GFSR doesn't take this additional step, I think this is something we're going to have to start worrying about. Not only are there financial consequences, but consequences for macroeconomies themselves. Jose also spoke about one other risk, which is about U.S. monetary policy and how that could have an effect. And here one starts seeing a very differentiated picture in the world economy. If U.S. interest rates were to rise, yes, a certain part of the world would be very concerned. But there would be a certain part of the world, Japan and Europe in particular, that I think would be very happy to see a stronger dollar, higher interest rates in the U.S. because it would serve them well. So in a sense, now we have this divergence between the advanced economies and emerging market economies becoming stronger, but for a very different set of reasons, that the way they perceive monetary policy in the U.S. becomes very fragmented because of their initial conditions. And the final comment I have is that this is going to have implications for the international monetary system. Because if you think about a poor little emerging market out there having this very difficult balancing act, worrying about U.S. monetary policy on the one hand and the attempts, laudable attempts, as Jose argued, of the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank to loosen monetary policy. You have emerging market economies essentially being caught by this whiplash effect of capital flows as the big players in financial markets start moving in opposite directions. And I think what we're going to see really is a return to the sort of reserve accumulation patterns we had back before the financial crisis and even soon thereafter, where we're going to have a fragmentation of the global monetary system where emerging market economies feel that they have little choice again but to protect themselves. And as we've seen, the orthodox answers, better policies, more flexible exchange rates, and deeper financial markets are not necessarily going to rescue them. So I suspect we are in a period of sort of artificial calm where things seem much calmer at the surface, but there are these very significant risks and tensions that are building up both in financial systems and the international monetary systems.
Thank you very much, Ezra. Let me add a few more points. One point, you know, there were lots of headlines. I mean, not yours. You were measuring financial risk. But the Financial Times, some, I think, 3 weeks ago, had this big thing about debt has increased. You know, overall world debt. Public sector plus non-financial private sector debt. Okay, and they kind of made a big deal out of it. And the numbers are quite significant. But on the other hand, when you think of the very low interest rates, I mean, isn't that what you would expect? And if you measure debt, you know, in present value terms, could one still say that it has increased? At the end of the day, I mean, like Daniel Gross wrote in a recent Project Syndicate piece, if interest rates are zero and maturities are very long, who cares? You know, is there really debt? So if you look at the world situation debt-wise, I mean, what, you know, on that point, what's your reaction? And the other point is one that the fund raised a year ago, roughly. And, you know, given the problems we're having with trying to navigate this exit from zero, from trying to manage the zero lower bound, on the one hand, the macroeconomics you talked about, but also the relative price issues, which are not that much mentioned in the macro debate, but the world is, you know, undergoing tremendous technological change. Mm-hmm. Skill mixes are going to have to be different. I would say relative salaries and wages will have to, will have to change. There will have to be a reorganization of the whole salary structure in a way to respond to the new technological revolution. So, what is the optimal inflation target under these? I mean, I personally would think that given what we've learned about the dangers and difficulties of managing the zero bound, and given the great structural changes that the world has to undergo, and therefore the need for relative price changes, and the fact that relative price changes are easier if you don't have to actually decrease wages of anybody, wouldn't, for example, a 3% broad inflation target be a much better macroeconomic target than a 2%? Now, I realize I'm asking this to a central banker who is viscerally you know, in the favor of maybe out of central bankers in general. But I wonder whether you have some words to say on that.
Okay, very good. Okay, excellent points, all of them, and I actually agree with most of what I heard on the part of the three of you. But let me just make a couple of comments, trying to bring things together. And what I want is to make a pitch for the role that prudential policies can play, both micro and particularly macro prudential policies can play, in avoiding some of the problems that I talked about and that you have referred to. Problems like lack of market liquidity, problems like the adverse consequences of low interest rates ending up in problems in life insurance companies or in mutual funds, or even that a number of countries faced with these global cross currents of capital inflows and reflows may decide to use heterodox means or capital controls, basically to protect themselves better from the vagaries of international capital flows. And I think that in all of these domains, prudential policies can be rather helpful. For example, there is a debate now going on in Europe in particular about the negative consequences of low interest rates or even negative interest rates. And it is true. If you look at European bond markets, about a third of, in terms of volume, of the sovereign bonds are in negative territory. And that creates challenges, and countries which are net savers like Germany, that's a big penalty for many people who have put their money into, you know, depositors in Switzerland as well, no? Depositors, Switzerland, Denmark, Sweden, Germany, many other countries are finding that their savers are being penalized. And this is something which is eliciting reactions, negative reactions. But I think that prudential policies can play a very important role in trying to control some of the negative side effects. For example, Doug was referring to life insurance companies. Half of the policies that have been written by European life insurers are far higher than what they can ever get in terms of long-term bond yields. So they should come to grips with reality. Prudential policies can play a very important role there. The issue of market liquidity risk, it may be that regulations may have to be recalibrated to see what is the impact of market liquidity that the jurists allow. But one thing is very, which is very important, is that we need better regulation, better oversight of systemic market liquidity, better oversight of the liquidity management in within the asset management industry. That's something that that could help as well. And finally, in terms of emerging markets, if they had better prudential policies or if they put in place better macroprudential policies, the fear of floating may diminish, and therefore they can be less contrary to using the exchange rate as a potential loss absorber. We know that when your financial system is weak, you fear about higher interest rates, or you fear about depreciation of the exchange rate, because that may create a problem. You have net for unhedged foreign exchange liability. So I think that prudential policies can play a very important role in mitigating the negative side effects of the very necessary accommodative policies that the world needs, very important role in enhancing market liquidity, and very important role in avoiding that emerging markets get sort of lead to a behave in a way that leads to a fragmentation of the international monetary system. So I think that this is something that could be helpful. On the issue of debt, is there more or less debt in the world? We have looked at this precisely in chapter one of the Global Financial Stability Report. And what we find is that if we concentrate, if we look at public sector debt, the answer is yes, there is more debt in the world. If one looks at private sector debt, then the answer is different. In fact, debt has come down. And if you look at not only gross debt, but net debt, meaning asset liabilities minus assets, this is something that also has come down.
But in some places, it has come down in a more painful way than others. For example, in the United States, macroeconomic deleveraging, basically reducing your debts as a result of higher growth, higher nominal growth, is something that has helped a lot more than in Europe or in Japan. So that's a bonus. Also in the United States, because quantitative easing policies were used earlier and the recovery picked up earlier, asset prices increased more. So the value of your assets increased faster relative to your debts, and therefore your net debts were coming down. That didn't happen in the United States and Japan, in the euro area in Japan, until very, very, very recently. So I think that there is more public debt. There is less net and gross private debt, but the leveraging still has a way to go. And I think that in that context, putting in place in certain parts of the world, and I will come back to the euro area, putting in place frameworks for private sector debt renegotiation is very important. One of the big problems that Europe has is that the corporate sector has a big debt overhang. And there is a need to recognize reality and enter into debt renegotiations with corporates, which are viable, but nevertheless are overburdened by private sector debt. And this is something which, you know, is being done little by little in Europe, but I think that this is going to gather strength in the future. And your last question of the optimal inflation target and the zero lower bound. Conceptually, I agree with the point you're making, which is sort of Tobin's grease in the wheels point, that you need some inflation. If you have downward nominal price and wage stickiness, you need some inflation in order to have the relative price changes that you need. And if you have more technological change, then that pushes you in that direction. So I would say that this is a presumption for having inflation rates which are not too close to zero. On the other hand, I think that if we fear about the zero lower bound, the experience shows that the zero lower bound is mainly hit when you run into a financial crisis. And from that viewpoint, if you can make the financial system a lot safer, that can reduce a lot the probability of running into the zero lower bound. So at the end of the day, I think that there is an intellectual debate out there of whether the zero lower bound is best solved with a little bit higher inflation targets, or with much safer financial systems. And you're adding another reason, which has to do with the technological impact on relative prices. I don't know where I come out, but my preference would be whatever we do with inflation target is to make sure that we also do lots of things to improve the safety of the financial system, because with 2 or 3%, if we get another crisis like this, we will hit the zero lower bound again. And unconventional monetary policies, they're useful, but they're not a perfect substitute for conventional monetary policies. And I think that we need also the conventional room for maneuver in case we get into another crisis.
Could I follow up on that issue of the unconventional monetary policies? So you spoke in very positive terms about the quantitative easing undertaken by the ECB and the BOJ. And you also pointed out, as you do in the report, that monetary policy by itself cannot do all the heavy lifting. You need the other policies to kick in. But the political reality is that not much is happening on the other policies. You have financial system risks potentially building up, as your report suggests, because of the unconventional monetary policies. So let's say a year from now, or by the end of this year, we find that the deflationary pressures have not eased in Europe and Japan. You have growth still essentially non-existent. Would you at that stage advocate even more monetary policy easing? Again, without having recourse to the right answer, which is that you need other policies to help.
Sure.
At that point, is the risk-return trade-off still positive?
Well, one would have to see, you know, exactly what's happening. And here, the problem is always with the counterfactual. What would have been the situation if the quantitative easing had not played a role? Would you have gone back to a significant recession and so on? Because let's not forget that the biggest problem, a big problem for financial stability, is if you don't put in place these policies and if the economy goes into a slump, then that's a killer for financial stability. So in terms of the cost and benefits of unconventional monetary policies, I think that they are decreasing returns.
I think that over time, the benefits are likely to be lower, but the question is whether they outweigh the costs. And I think that if you look at Europe at present, to me, the benefits still outweigh the costs. And I would like to see things going forward and then do the calculation, you know, over time. So I don't have a dogmatic position there. But my impression is that without the quantitative easing policies of the ECB, given where they were when they started thinking about it, we would have been now in a much worse situation. And I also think that the policies of the Federal Reserve have been very important in getting this economy out of the problems they had. In fact, I think that the problem that the ECB had was that they deflated their balance sheet at a time where they should have continued inflating it, and now they are going back to inflating it again. So I think that in a way the ECB got out of some of the quantitative easing policies that they were doing in a premature manner, and now they're going back. And I personally think that this is good news. But if we update this conversation in a year, maybe we can have an interesting discussion again.
Doug, do you want to? No? So we'll open it to the floor then. So please, those who want to ask a question, do identify yourself. Start with Uri, then you, and is there anybody on this side? Okay, then we'll take three questions at a time.
Uri Dadush with the Carnegie Endowment. Thanks, Jose. Wonderful presentation. I have to say that I felt like the first time you go to see a doctor and he gives you the list of diseases and you have to tick off what you have and don't have. And by the end of it, you feel very, very nervous. What I really want to know is, from this list of diseases, what's number one that really worries you over the next 12 months? And by the way, I noticed you didn't even mention Greece as a possible disease.
What did you say?
Was
that? Was that?
Greece.
I know. Okay, Greece is a beautiful country rather than a disease.
Yes.
Let me tell you that. But let me answer.
Let's take first.
Okay, are you going to take first?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Wesley, ex-IDB and World Bank. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the impact, if any, that this long period of low interest rates has had on property and stock market valuations. Are we starting to get some froth anywhere there?
Thank you. And the third question? Coming.
Rodrigo Valderrama, Plantation International. With regard to the market liquidity that you mentioned, and yet you have bank liquidity in Europe, what's the scenario now for the developing countries with this market liquidity crunch? And with the higher interest rates in Germany, Is that going to be sort of like the tail that moves interest rates elsewhere a little higher?
On the first question, what is the number one worry that I would have? Of the challenges that I have presented there, the thing that I worry the most as a structural issue is the low market liquidity. In the crisis, we had a lot of leverage. And when things went sour, then there was a precipitous attempt to deleverage, and there were lots of fire sales and markets right up. Now we don't have that much leverage in the financial system, at least in the banking system. But what we have is the potential for leverage-like behavior in the sense that the volume of funds which are potentially prone to running towards the exit door is so huge now compared to the exit door that markets are likely to be overwhelmed. So this is the problem with market liquidity, the potential volume of funds trying to run over there, and the exit door, which may have become narrower, maybe as a result of some of the regulations that Doug was talking about. So that is going to be a very important issue to solve. and we need to move fast. This is something that we have been worrying at the fund for more than a year. I have been putting this at the center of the discussions that we have with the officials during our springs and annual meetings for the last year and a half. Now it is something which has been embraced by the Financial Stability Board in its work program for a year. Now I think it's getting the credit that it deserves, but to me it's a very important issue. And it's not easy to solve because it requires a lot of analysis and also a lot of experimentation with policy tools which are relatively new. So I think that's, to me, a very central theme. And you're right, I didn't mention the word of Greece. I could have added another challenge, which has to do with other risks, like geopolitical risks, Russia, Ukraine, or risks coming from the situation in the Middle East, or risks inherent in the Greek situation. As you can imagine, we are devoting quite a bit of time inside of my institution to working together with our European colleagues and the Greek government to find a solution to a difficult case. And our ultimate objective and our common objective of ourselves, the European Central Bank, the European Commission, is to put Greece back on the path of growth and stability. But this is taking some time, and time is not abandoned here, given the calendar of payments that Greece must make. But it is an issue, but our baseline scenario is still that we will work hard as it takes in order to get a good agreement, not any agreement, a good agreement that can put Greece back on the path of growth and stability. But it's not easy, and there's still quite a bit of progress that needs to be made. But again, this is something which is important. I didn't talk about it, but it is relevant. Valuations, equity valuations, and how the low interest rates are affecting these equity valuations. Well, if you look at equity valuations in Europe, according to fair value models, you cannot say that equity prices in Europe are overvalued. And if you look at the United States, equity valuations, depending on some indexes, are okay, depending on others, are a little bit too richly valued. That's a close call. This morning we had a good conversation at the fund between Christine Lagarde and Chairwoman Yellen, and this issue came up. Her assessment was that United States equity prices are not overvalued. In our assessment, we don't see them out of line. But again, if the situation were to continue and they were to continue going up and earnings expectations were not matching that path, then we would start worrying about it. So far, I don't think that one should panic about it, but going forward, one should be careful. And the last question that you asked, I wasn't sure whether I understood the question, so forgive me if I give you the answer, which I think is right, but may not be what you're asking. You were talking about market liquidity again. You mentioned something about German interest rates rising.
Just a sec, so that other people can hear also. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, almost two questions in the sense that you've got a squeeze in market liquidity and how that can affect developing countries with lower exports, et cetera, and how the interest rates in Germany that are starting to trend higher can affect also interest rates elsewhere, which would also affect, obviously, the developed and the developing countries.
Okay, can I just add, you know, there is, in many developing countries, there is this press coverage and this chatter that, you know, a 50 basis points increase in Fed policy rates or 75 basis points increase in Fed policy rates is going to spell disaster, you know? And so, I mean, isn't that vastly exaggerated? In other words, haven't markets already looked forward to this? Have priced it in? And moreover, given the U.S. situation, given the, you know, the somewhat doubtful strength of the recent numbers and so on, I mean,
isn't the best assumption that whatever the Fed will do, it will be extremely cautious and gradual. Given all that, is there an overblown fear of decompression in the emerging markets that maybe mask their own structural weaknesses much more than what the Fed will do?
I think that the Fed has always been emphasizing that they are going to try to be very cautious and very gradual, and that any move they make would be data dependent or state dependent. So on that part, I think that's fine. It's true that the term premium is extremely compressed and that it's more than 100, 120 basis points below what would be the historical average. So we are talking, you know, about, you know, without talking about the movements in the policy rates, a potential for the compression of the term premium, which could be quite large. The thing is whether this decompression is going to happen on a smooth manner or on a rapid manner. And if it happens in a very rapid manner, there could be some volatility and some repercussions. But one lesson that we learned in the taper tantrum episode is that even if at the beginning, the first couple of weeks, everybody was affected similarly, regardless of your fundamentals, then over time, countries which had better fundamentals were able to do much better. And countries which reacted and started putting in place the policies that improve the credibility of the policy frameworks, their fundamentals, also elicited a much better response on the part of markets and stabilized. For example, Turkey. Turkey was hit again in January of 2014. And then there were actions by the central bank, which was behind the curve in terms of raising interest rates. That helped a lot. India and Indonesia, which were among the so-called fragile five by some market analysts in the first round of the taper tantrum, did their homework. And then later on, they were not much affected. So I think that the taper tantrum revealed the value of having good fundamentals. So I think that countries which have good fundamentals should be in a lot more comfortable position, although it is true that there could be a rapid decompression of the term premium, which may add to the changes in policy rates. So you can have both things happening. So I would be cautious on that in any case. But I agree, the fear should not be overblown. On the question of the impact on developing economies, yes, one problem in a number of developing economies, is our emerging markets rather, is that there is now a lot of the, think of Mexico, there is a lot of the debt which is now in the hands of foreign investors. And the question is, how strong is your domestic base in case these investors want to run? To what extent is there a domestic counterpart to take that slack? And that's an issue. So the probability that you may have very significant adjustments in emerging markets and some drop in liquidity in domestic bond markets may be high if there is some high global volatility. Which brings me to the issue that emerging markets need to have ready the means of providing liquidity both in local currency and in foreign currency. And I will do some advertisement. The flexible credit line of the IMF that countries like Mexico, like Colombia, like Poland have, I think is a very good insurance policy against this foreign exchange illiquidity. And I wish that more countries would be willing to come and take that up. And on Germany, interest rates going up in Germany, one very interesting thing. Since the Jackson Hole speech of Mario Draghi in August, what we have seen is some reverse causality in the pattern of long-term interest rates internationally. Traditionally, long-term interest rates in the United States affected long-term interest rates in Europe. Since August, what we're seeing is that interest rates in Europe, long-term interest rates in Europe coming down, have been affected long-term interest rates in the United States, which have also kept rather down because of the capital inflows that had been coming in. Interestingly too, a few weeks ago, since the 20th of April, the Bund rate, the long-term interest rate in Germany, has been going up quite significantly. You know what? The long-term interest rate in the United States has moved in sync. So there is this reverse causality. The question is whether this is going to be just a temporary aberration or whether this is going to be there to stay. Because if that's the case, and the Fed exits, and the euro, you know, the euro area continues with the quantitative easing policies, and this leads to a policy rate differential, which is increasing in favor in the United States, money is going to keep coming in the United States, and people, foreigners are going to keep buying treasuries. So there, what you would have is rather than the decompression of the term premium, that the term premium remains low. And then the Fed will have to do something if they feel that the tightening of monetary conditions and financial conditions is not what they wanted to achieve by the increase in policy rate. And that may be crucial for the implications that this may have for foreign exchange markets. So for all of those who are short of dollars and unhedged positions, that may be something to focus on.
All right, I think we have time to 2:45, so we're closing. Any last minute from our two discussants, Doug?
Yeah, if I could just follow up. I think Jose is right to be focusing on the risks that exist from the decompression of the interest rate spreads that have existed. I very much agree with that. One reason that I agree with him is because the reaction of markets is intrinsically unknowable in this situation. It's intrinsically unknowable for multiple reasons. One is some number of investors have taken on more risk than they should have. But that's a fairly subjective measurement. We'd have to know what each investor's base level of position should be, and then judge how that, compare that to their actual positions. We don't have great information on the actual positions of different types of investors, and we don't know what their base level should be, and therefore we don't know the pressures they'll feel when they see the need to adjust. Secondly, much of what happens in the markets in the short run is people making judgments about what everybody else's situation is and what everybody else is therefore likely to be. And that's going to be very much dependent on what's happening right at the time. And that's why in the short run you can get very strong reactions to things that you wouldn't think at a given point in time should have been making that much difference. And other times something you would think would make a big difference doesn't make that much difference. I think we just have to recognize there's a pretty wide range of potential results when you're talking about market reactions.
All right. We do have to thank you very much. You agree basically what Doug said?
Yes, I do.
It was very much what you said also. Well, thank you. You gave us a really wonderful, focused, and yet extremely comprehensive view of the state of the financial world and monetary policy, I guess. I think showing again that, you know, the IMF is one of the pillars of multilateral debate and research and policy advice that we have, which should be appreciated in my view, because we don't have many institutions with that degree of kind of seriousness and that degree of skill. And of course, Jose Vinal is one of the leaders of that institution. So thanks for sharing the time with us.
My pleasure.
And good luck to you and all of your colleagues to manage these risks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.